employees that had been fired or quit since. So already it's a huge task for any union to take on. As far as what made us successful, I would say, you know, a lot of it was endurance. We had a model of organizing that was very much worker to worker. We were inside the warehouse, building relationships with people, creating that sense of community. We started as an independent union, so we were basically a blank slate. There wasn't much Amazon could do to union bust or try to third party and separate people from the union, which is a common tactic that these corporations often try to do. They try to third party the union, make workers feel as though it's something that they're not a part of, they're not responsible for. And so I think a lot of things kind of aligned in our case that we were able to be victorious when it's clearly really a struggle to organize and unionize these warehouses.
We just have 10 seconds. Why did you decide to affiliate with Teamsters?
It's national organizing is too much for an independent union to do by ourselves. And if we want to have a chance of taking Amazon to the table, creating that pressure, there has to be national organizing.
I want to thank you both for being with us. The film opens this week.
This Wednesday at IFC Center in New York City and then across the country.
Steve Meng is co-director of Union. Connor Spence is president of the Amazon Labor Union, IBT Local 1. Again, happy birthday to Juan Gonzalez. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Offbeat sounds for talented listeners. Broadcasts every other Wednesday at 10 p.m.
There was heaven, and there was earth.
Después de esa pieza, vamos a escuchar una comunicación simpática y cruel con ánimo.
That's Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO has a mobile app. You can listen to all your favorite shows, subscribe to KBOO Podcast, even set KBOO as your alarm clock. Just look for KBOO on the iTunes and Google Play Store. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review.
Oh, what a world. KBOO 90.7. Dasha T said that.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's just after 8 a.m. on Tuesday. It's time for Too Much Information with your host, Tracy Simmons. Do stay tuned.
Good morning. It's Tracy Simmons here on your radio dial, KBOO 90.7 FM, and this is Too Much Information. I am here by myself this morning. Abe is out, and I actually don't feel very well, so please don't call me this morning yelling at me and being angry. I am really just kind of shifting away from the content of this very contentious, quite gross election, to really get into the underlying sentiments of the American electorate. So, you know, I typically kind of look towards different research entities, and Pew Research has done a considerable amount of research, you know, just looking at, like, what are the American sentiments around the political divide, political polarization, And Pew Research is an amazing think tank, and they've been doing research for a long time. And so I'm pulling out a report from September 2023, so over a year ago, but it's kind of continued. So this research has been continuing since then to really think about, like, how did we get here as a nation? And so that's kind of the conversation. Really, not only how did we get here, but can we? How do we get ourselves out of this space? So I'll talk a little bit about just what the research is showing and what the data is telling us. And then, you know, maybe open up the door for you all to call me and tell me, how did we get here? How do we get out of this? Is it possible? Is this just that, you know, space that we've talked about before, late-stage empire, late-stage capitalism, where, you know, folks are so disgusted by American politics and the direction it's gone, that folks just really don't even want to talk about it, feel a sense of anxiety thinking about it, want to tune out, but no, they can't tune out. Like, where are we as a nation, and how do we move ourselves towards something different, towards something better? So that's the conversation. The number to dial is 503-231-8187. Don't leave me hanging, so I have to talk to myself for an hour. But I do think this is an important conversation because it shrouds everything that we're seeing right now, a year later after this initial survey was done. And typically what Pew does, the research methods include survey data, but also, polling data, information. They have a really good methodology, and that's why I typically look to them for what they find. And so, you know, I think there's been a long-standing conversation about, critical, views of the political system, skeptic, ideas about the federal government and who it actually serves, right? We talk about that all the time on this program. We've talked about the military industrial complex. We've talked about the prison industrial complex. We've talked about the money in elections, and specifically the dark money in elections that shroud the American people's actual voice in what we want, right? So we talk about the political warfare and the nasty playing politics. We talk about the mainstream media and how they try and normalize some of the bizarre things that we've been seeing for the past, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. What the top line of all of this is, if we have such a negative view of our political system, what will people do to try and fix it? Is it possible to be fixed? Are we in that space that, the end is near and it will take some kind of revolution? And I can consistently say the revolution has to be love because it can't be anything else. There's way too much to risk. Really interested in hearing from you all. So I'll start with this. Just 4% of U.S. adults say the political system is working extremely or very well. Unfortunately, about 6 in 10, 63%, express not too much or no confidence at all in the future of the U.S. political system, right? So we talk frequently about the two-party system, how it is corrupt, it is absolutely not supporting the needs of the people, nor the wants of the people, right? The system that is entrenched and bifurcated in some way, where many of the politicians on either side of that system are being paid by the same people to do the same things and to show up in the same way, right? Like we talk about all the time. There's a historic low of views, positive views of, how they trust the federal government. 16% of U.S. Americans say they trust the federal government always or most of the time. It's been pretty low for a long time, but it stands at the lowest levels dating back 7 decades. So, do the math there. We're talking the 1950s. the opinion of the Supreme Court has typically been favorable to neutral. Typical. That's long-term data. So this is going back to the 1980s. And at this point, there is a unfavorable view of the Supreme Court. So, right, Supreme Court plays such a big role in what we, the American people, get, what happens with regard to laws that are on the books that are challenged or not challenged. They play such an extreme role. And we know that many of us see the current Supreme Court as deeply corrupt and bought and sold, basically, as we hear more and more commentary about folks like Clarence Thomas and Brett Kavanaugh and how they were literally paid for, others like Amy Coney Barrett. This is where we find ourselves. We find ourselves being stripped of our rights by a overwhelming majority of people who are on the Supreme Court who got there in a corrupt way. And there's no taking it back. There's really no way, no one is doing anything about it, right? And so this is why I always say, no one's coming to save us. We're going to have to save ourselves. We're going to have to do something as the U.S. adults that we are talking about. A growing share of the public dislikes both political parties. Nearly 3 in 10, or a third, express unfavorable views of both parties, the highest share in 3 decades of polling. And, 25%, 1 in 4 American U.S. adults do not feel well represented by either party. That's a lot of folks, right? And once again, right, as I'm talking to folks on kind of both sides, I try not to both sides things, but I do know folks who exist in a world where, long-term conservative views have been part of who they are and how they show up, as well as folks who are similar to me, who are left of center, and folks who are either further on the left. I would say all of us are feeling like this two-party system is not working, one, and no, neither of these folks, neither of these groups represent my personal interests as a human in this society in 2024. So, just some things to start with. We've got Santiago on the line. Want to get 2 callers, and I'll jump back into the data. Good morning, Santiago.
Good morning.
Hi.
I think that's when it comes to the data, I mean, it's really, Pew's pretty on point, and I think a lot of people feel the way that they do because, we have Google now, and we understand where we can find out with the simple Google search, like, who's who, what they do, who they're represented by, and I think it's a cognitive dissonance because we have the establishment on the one hand that really pushes the idea of electoralism as a way to solve your problems, but at the same time, that electoralism only leads to one of 2 choices, which are essentially just controlled opposition. Now, a lot of people will say, you can argue that the Democrats are much better in certain areas than Republicans, and I may grant you that to an extent, but on the real substantive views, the only separation between how they do stuff is just optics. I mean, occasionally they'll do something right, like Biden not, refusing to pull a Taft-Hartley on the dock workers. Great move, considering how bad it was for him to have unilaterally stopped the rail strike either last year or 2 years ago. So he definitely learned his lesson there. But at the same time, we watched how the talking points evolved for Kamala Harris and Tim Walz post-DNC and pre-DNC. And right now, they went from having like a three-point lead on Trump to essentially being within the same margin of error as Trump, slightly varying numbers, but the same margin of error. And it's really because, you know, the establishment can only move so far to the left without causing problems. And I think people see that. And it's, you know, it's hard for them to be invested in a system that fundamentally, whether they have a politician they like or not, fundamentally does not and has never cared. I think, you know, because I was reading your prompt for the show, which was optimism, and I think optimism, you can't have optimism in this situation, because we understand that we have cancer, but the people who are trying to tell us what the problem is telling, we just have a headache, you know. Oh, and it's not a, you know, and it's like when we see all the symptoms of cancer, but we're being told we have a headache, it's hard to be optimistic when you're being lied to your face, you know, whereas if we were told the truth about our system, it might be a harder pill to swallow, but at least we would at least be on steady footing with understanding where we are. And it's not a mere issue of like just simply being optimistic. It's like you can't even adopt a good defensive posture if you don't even know where to put your feet. And that's why, you know, saying, as much as it hurts, that the Democrats and the Republicans do not offer much different substantively, while that may hurt to hear and doesn't always bear out in anecdotal passings, it's bared out through historical materialism, how they function. And it's really not saying that, you know, it's saying that the whole system, this system was not made for us. It was a dress that was made for somebody else, and there's only so many times we can alter it before we have to collectively say we need a new garment. And that's exactly where we are. They're trying to force us into a garment that hasn't fit us for over 150 years. And people are tired of putting on this ill-fitting garment, but we're being told we look great in it. It fits just fine. The problem is you. It's not this dress we're putting you in. It's you that's the problem, when we clearly know it's the dress. You know what I'm saying? So we have to find our optimism in truth, not in you know, in materialism, not idealism, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, I think when I hear what you're saying, I wonder, can anger get us there? People are emotionally tapped out, and 55% feel angry that the politics don't work. They always feel exhausted, 65% when thinking about politics, and 55% feel angry. Is anger a motivating factor, is the question, especially if you are angry and exhausted?
No, I think if we have our anger properly placed, it'll be harder for us to tap out. Because right now we're being told to be angry at it's like cutting the heads off a hydra, and that's how we're being told to focus our anger, is just cutting off the heads that appear. Or, you know, our anger is like, I used to call it like if we have like a vomit cleanup service, and we're being told to race around cleaning up all the sickness, all the effects of the sickness, but we're not treating the sickness. And so we're exhausted because we're trying to put out, I guess maybe we're exhausted from putting out little fires that pop up here and there when we're not going after the arsonists. We're not going after the people who are making us sick. The people who are making us sick are telling us that they're not the problem. the arsonists are dressing themselves up as firefighters and telling us not to look at them. But the thing is that the arsonists are people you like and people you don't like. And if we have our anger directed at the arsonists rather than the fire, the sickness givers rather than the people with the sickness, then it'll be harder for our anger to be tapped out. Because right now, people are tired of defensive voting. They want offensive voting. They want something where they can act. They're not trying to protect themselves from something. They're trying to get themselves something that they want. We have politicians that are saying, we are just good enough, and if it's your problem that you're not fine with that, then I'm sorry. I don't know what to tell you. But that's where we've been put. Because once again, you were talking about revolution earlier. The people who gave the politicians are the ones who eventually bent the knee to the people. But the people have to be mobilized. They have to be organized. I keep telling people, you know, the people who are quote unquote both sides understand that the best our economy was post New Deal. But people don't understand how the New Deal was got. You know, FDR wasn't a nice guy. FDR was forced to bend the knee by organizing from communists, from socialists, to syndicalists, to unions. Everybody was organized. Granted, they might have had different caste or class interests, but essentially, at the end of the day, the biggest organizer was labor. And this was just after the October Revolution in Russia, and they basically told FDR, if you don't give us what we want, we are going to do to you what the Bolsheviks did in Russia. And ultimately, FDR understood what that meant. And this is a guy who was pro-capitalist, virulently anti-communist, and it showed later on after the New Deal because of the purging of socialists and communists. But the fact of the matter was that the people were organized enough to create a threat. And people are uncomfortable with that. People are uncomfortable with threatening power because we're told that violence isn't the answer, but violence is how the rich people got everything they got. They justify it. Mm. They justify
all right,
the
well,
violence against
I've them. Got other folks on the line, Santiago, so I want to give other folks a chance. But
that's fine.
Woo! Kicking with fire. Thank you so much for what you bring to the show. I'm hearing you. I agree with Santiago that a certain level of anger, if it is placed in the right, in the right kind of focus, will help us. But if folks are both angry and exhausted, meaning, right, there's an anger that is shrouded in apathy, a lack of wanting to mobilize together, a lack of wanting to do anything because it's been bombarded at them over and over again. You've got to pick the lesser of two evils. You've got to, just hold your nose and vote, right? You've got to, this system is designed to not fix itself and really can't be fixed at all. It's meant to maintain the status quo, right? That's exhausting. So I think, using some anger with a direct focus on what we want to accomplish and do might be the way. I've got James on the line. James, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
When we gave the federal government the power to tax and regulate industry, what that did, it enabled the ruling class to purchase the political class, the federal government, and what they've done is divided the American people up into various factions. They've used the American people's wealth to divide the American people up into various factions, and they've kept us divided and owned. That's the primary problem. The federal government was never delegated the power to tax and regulate industry. The people reserve that power to themselves at the community level. That's what federalism was all about. People having the power to tax and regulate monopolies out of existence at the community level.
So do you think that's happening, or like, I mean...
No. Well, what I think's happening is that the ruling class has used the people's wealth to enslave them.
Mm.
That's what's happened. I mean, they literally used our wealth to enslave us.
Right. And say that they're the ones who are the keepers of the wealth, and we wouldn't exist without them, when it's really the other way around, right? When we think about workers' rights and who is the, you know, producers of the actual work and the output, right? We are the people.
Well, see, this is part of the problem. You've divided the people. We are people. We are not workers. We are not gay. We are not straight. We are not white. We are not black. We are people.
Okay.
It's we, the people.
So how do you get past the division? What does that even look like? People have been put into these factions, and now their whole identities are based on this, you know, this is who I am, and these are my people. And, you know, we think about tribalism and how that shows up in the way people vote and the way people participate politically. What do you think about that?
We have to change our how we view the world, because we have been taken hostage on the emotional level by the ruling class through the state, through the all-powerful fascist totalitarian state. That's what we live under. It is fascist totalitarianism.
Great.
And I would really love to make the point that what the left characterizes as capitalism, state capitalism, is an oxymoron. Capitalism is when the means of production is in private hands. Now, I get that the ruling class, you know, are private individuals, but if the ruling class is using the state to enslave the people, then the means of production are not in private hands. It's in the hands of the state, and the ruling class is using the state to enslave the people. So we have to put the means of production in the hands of the people, and we do that when the people have the power to tax and regulate industry at the community level. That means that political and economic power is evenly distributed throughout society. You understand what I'm saying?
I got you. Thank you so much for your call. All right. I've got Blake on the line. Good morning, Blake.
Hi. Thank you so much. Love your show. And it needs to have more callers and more discussion. Santiago, thank you. And we need to... Okay. Something I heard a couple of weeks ago, that the only thing that humans as animals have contributed to the planet positively, because we're in a positive mood here, is story, the word and the reason and the story of it. I want us to think about our, you know, our present story and how we live it, and how we are our Facebook and Instagram algorithms, like, you know, and where does this revolution of love come from? You know, in this new time, we can see the horrors anywhere in the world and right in our backyard instantly. And you know, check your facts for sure. You know, but we have to spread this story. We have to, we have to arrange our lives to listen to what's really happening. And this word that's just come up recently in my life is like the technocracy, and how the ruling class, yeah, they all got us emotionally, mentally enslaved in the system, and now we're seeing it physically. You know, in my life, I can't dream of buying a house, you know, even though I went to college, you know, and flunked twice out of grad school. But, you know, like that dream died a long time ago, but now the struggle is real, that I'm paying my landlord's, you know, a mortgage. It's like, oh shit, okay. Yeah, you know, and then what is my small part in the big story, and then how can I look for change and hope, and where do I look for this? It's not black and white. I know that now. And we have to keep on telling the story, the real story of who, you know, the founders that we based our country on warmongers. You know, nobody knows the real nickname of Washington among the people who were here is Village Destroyer in the French Indian War. That's what he was called. And then he still wasn't all evil. He still, you know, had his teeth replaced by slaves' teeth. Yes, evil, but he said the two-party system is not going to go. He said the stuff is, he said, you know, he saw the end in the beginning. And it's sad to you know, I don't know any real Jill Stein supporters, but if I did, I would have to tell them that, you know, now is the time, I guess, not to revolution and you know, Kamala is a step in the right step, but, and it's in the right direction for sure, but we got to realign. It's about mindfulness. It's about being aware again, like we were before the smartphone, like when we had to wait and we had to read and hear stories and we got to be smart again. We got to hear these stories and you have to align your life so that you're not just being pushed consumerism and you have to have this hope for change, which I'm looking for hardcore. You got to look near and far, you know, one place. Yeah. So I don't know, but I'm going to keep tuning in and to Hartman too, although he needs to run for something, man. He can't just sit there on the radio all the time. He's got to make change. We all got to make the change. Little community.
I keep saying it. No one's coming to save us. We're going to have to save ourselves. Thank you so much, Blake. Right. I've got Mark on the line. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Hope is really a command, as the theologian Jürgen Moltmann insisted. Unlike the rest of creation, we can go beyond everything past and present in the power of the coming, the power of the promise. It's a very powerful thesis, and we need to think spiritually. We need to be adamant counterculturists or post-materialists. I saw an incredible hour-and-a-half documentary on YouTube titled JFK, A Betrayed President. And this shows how warmongers in the CIA and in the Secret Service, Alan Dulles in particular, wanted to attack Cuba and wanted to attack the Soviet Union. This is a very revitalizing a program which can kind of dispel some of the uncertainty we have about the past and about the terrible media reporting. It can show that our system is really infected by this scapegoating, by a hatred of Russia and Cuba, a hatred of progressive politics. We face the same evil. I get so tired hearing of C.J. Vance 6 times a day saying that China is stealing our jobs. Well, you know, hope is a command, and maybe that means focusing on alternative media. You know, we are scapegoating immigrants. We're scapegoating the Chinese, scapegoating Russia, scapegoating protesters. Trump actually said he would arrest all of the protesters. He said he would prosecute his enemies, political critics. I, as a German translator, I can't imagine anyone being more vile, vicious, and vulgar. He's really the loose cannon that is without a doubt any, you know. So we have to be hopeful. Kamala wins, and we can begin again. She at least counsels people. She actually, you know, talks about how their suffering could be mitigated, and that is very great. In a way, she is more removed from the vested interest than almost any other candidate in our history. So I recommend you watching this documentary on JFK, A Betrayed President. And, of course, we have to be grounded in Santiago's critical thinking. And that the majority rule has to be balanced with minority rights. That's very exciting. And the corporate media just blocks things, of course, and maybe the New York Times gives seven times more stories to Trump than to Kamala. Well, this depresses the people, right? That's my perspective. I thank you very much for your passion.
Thank you so much for calling, Mark. So, getting back to this data set, in the Pew report, it says more than 8 in 10, 86% of adult Americans say the following is a good description of politics. Republicans and Democrats are more focused on fighting each other than on solving problems. And, you know, this is kind of a both sides-ism a little bit for me, but it's true. And I think this is where folks get really frustrated, this idea that, you know, neither folks want to actually solve the problem because they won't have something to run against, run on, right? You know, even thinking about Trump and the fact that Trump is still a free person despite being multi times charged and convicted, right? Like, if that was anybody else, right? But because, oh, well, we don't want to look like we're going after our political enemies. No, you want that as an enemy so that you can get elected, right? Like, this is what keeps coming up for me. Deeper down in the data, what's interesting is too little attention goes to, according to the American people, 78% say too little attention goes to important issues facing the country. So I think, you know, someone named this scapegoating of immigrants. That's not really a problem, right? These are manufactured problems. We spent over 2 years talking about trans people and should they be able to take care of their bodies and you know, use restrooms in public and play sports. And it's like, what? That's not even a problem. You are seeking an intervention for something that is not even a problem, right? We have to talk about all of these things that are irrelevant and immaterial to people's daily lives. And they get so much attention that we don't talk about things like wage stagnation. We don't talk about things like wage theft. We don't talk about things like, why is the cost of housing so out of step with an average American's income? And this is related to what one of our callers saying that they will never be able to purchase a home, right? Like, the things that matter to people are not on the menu for the politicians because they are so far removed from an average American's daily life because they have got into a place with money. And now they can't even relate, you know. And I think about like Tim Walz, and as much as a milquetoast I think he is, right, he is relatable to regular people because he has a very regular life and history. And I think there's something about that that is endearing. But, you know, as soon as the you know, kind of conversation switches from that which is important to actual people to getting sucked into this conversation, fighting back against, you know, J.D. Vance and his spewing this bile about immigrants and spewing this bile about women and their bodies and their ability to take care of their bodies, right? We don't even get to the actual topics. And I think there's something about that that's also exhausting. I have to hear all of this political rhetoric, but none of it really speaks to what I care about. Right? No one is out there saying there is a genocide happening in Gaza right now, and we need to do something about it, right? And I think that that literally angers people to a level where they are so checked out and so not wanting to vote for either of the candidates, especially when we think about a duopoly. And then we have this kind of insertion of other rhetoric that just takes the stage from us and doesn't allow us to really focus on the things that matter to us. And I think that is an exhausting, you know, space of swirling and being upset. I think, you know, the thing that gets too much attention, according to U.S. adults, 57% said disagreements between Republicans and Democrats. This continuing to polarize people into tribes. Because if you're on one side of that argument and you're on the other side of that argument, then this polarization is happening. And that polarization consistently pits people against each other for things that they don't even have a problem with. They're not even really arguing about, right? So when we think about even U.S. adults' sentiments around abortion has been a hot-button topic for so long. Why? Because at least 70% of the U.S. population believes women should have a right to choose. So why does this keep coming up as a hot button, not only topic, but also a political, you know, bargaining chip? That's really what it's become, as opposed to thinking about, well, guess what? There's no laws on the books that prevent men from doing anything with their bodies. Why wouldn't we think about it in that way? Why would we have such a law? Interesting here, right? And I think this is where, you know, folks get into, especially me, thinking about the role of the Supreme Court in Citizens United and the reality about dark money in politics. And the public says that because of the cost of political campaigns, 85% of U.S. adults say it's hard for good people to run for office. I'm truly a believer in the fact that if you are frustrated at the people who have been put up in front of you to choose and you think you can do it better, please run for something. There's an organization called Run for Something, and they support, you know, low-money candidates, under-resourced candidates with helping understand how to run a political campaign. And I think the best way that you can do that is get involved at the local level. Start somewhere. And I think it's really important because those rich people will continue showing up every election to be elected to something, to tell you how to, you know, not tax them and how to run your life, knowing that their life is very different from yours, right? And so we know that the special interests as well, and lobbyists and all of the, you know, we talk on this program every week about the Israel lobby and how much it plays a part in our daily lives through the pulling of the purse strings of our politicians. And, right, if 84% of people think that's a problem, what is our hope? What is our desire? What is our will to make some change, right? But what's interesting in the current structure of our political system to actually make positive change is also an exhausting ideology, right? Because if you think about a political body, which is in this case the Supreme Court, which approved Citizens United, which says dark money can flow into anyone's campaign and we really can't do much about it, especially if it's, you know, certain people. We know certain people are getting all kinds of dark money
And they will continue to get that money because we don't have a check and balance system there. But to change that, right, means changing the Supreme Court. So we need to get a person in the presidency to, over time, right, appoint different kinds of people onto the Supreme Court. That won't happen if a certain person becomes the president, right? So we have to recognize how these systems are working and either decide we're going to have to do the long-term investment to change the system, or it's just going to be the way it is. And I think that in itself, for me personally, is exhausting to think about another, 15 years waiting for people to die off the Supreme Court. I mean, give me a break, y'all. It's insane. I think, too, you know, there is the, of course, politicians who have these amazing portfolios. And so I have a group of people who are looking at these investments and kind of following along. So Nancy Pelosi is a good example of this. Nancy Pelosi's stock investments continue to make money for her. She's raking in money by playing the stock market. Now, of course, we've talked about things like insider trading. We've talked about things like, you know, regular people, if you do that, right, you're going to jail. Somehow there's some kind of political protection. And we've said it multiple times as the American people. People in those high places who get to make policy and know about things before any of us do should not have the ability to make money off the backs of us through the market because they have that access to that knowledge, right? And so this question about money in politics, of course, if you're a person who can benefit from that and you get into a high place, you're not going to think about the actual people you are supposed to be representing when your own financial interests are merged with your political interests. You know, I think the donor class as well, right? And I've talked about this on the program. 80% say that those people have too much influence on decisions made by members of Congress. This is kind of why I think Kamala can't say, you know, we need to put an arms embargo on Israel. She can't say that right now. She will not get elected if she says that right now. We know that Trump ain't going to do it. I'm just going to tell you right now. Trump's going to give them all the guns, all the armaments, all the weapons. And if we think that Kamala Harris is a reasonable person and we continue to put pressure on Kamala Harris and not the other guy, right, what are we saying? Even with that, we're tacitly saying that one of those people is more able to be moved than the other. The other person is immovable. Actually, he was on stage for 40 plus minutes last night, slightly moving, saying nothing, which was supposed to be a town hall, to an interesting playlist of songs that he approves of, including Ave Maria, but they did not play the right Ave Maria. So just even thinking about the influence that people with money, of course, the lobbyists, the moneyed interests, all of those people, Americans see it, but yet we are stuck in this system that doesn't give us hope that it can be changed. And that's frustrating, right? Especially if you know that this is a material problem, yet you have to continue going along with the system. Another source of exhaustion, depression, anger, frustration. And, you know, the thing about the American psyche and just the human psyche in general is that the longer you spend in those emotions, the more apathetic, the more that frustration causes you to tune out, causes you to just, you know, hey, I don't even want to talk about it. So I think that's important to recognize. Neither party is particularly popular with the public. Only 4 in 10 adults have a favorable view of the Democratic Party, while about as many, 36%, have a favorable impression of the Republican Party. Now we know that a huge swath of people who can vote every time it's an opportunity to vote do, right? Just a huge group do. But an equally huge group just stay home. They don't even pay attention. They're not even involved. They're not even engaged.
And I think it's due to this, right? If you have a duopoly and only, you know, a third of all of the people see the value of either of those parties, do you think they're going to be doing a lot? Especially, you know, given the current state of voter suppression, voter intimidation, misinformation, disinformation. It takes work to figure out who you should vote for. It takes work to try and find the truth about candidates, to find the truth about their policy positions, find the truth about anything anymore. And so the people who don't appreciate you know, the current system just tune out. They just tune out. And I think this has a huge impact on what we get, the willingness of folks to turn out and to really engage deeply in the electoral process. And once again, I will say this until I'm blue in the face, until I'm in, you know, somebody's crematorium, because I don't believe in burying whole bodies. Anyways, I will say this until I'm blue in the face. This is just one of the ways in which we engage our community. Voting is just one of the ways. It's only one of many, a multitude of strategies. I can't say that enough. So, you know, I think what's interesting is people say over and over again that Americans say this, that they are open to having more parties. They think that it would actually make things easier as a society. However, right, the people who currently benefit from the way things are will continue to keep it the way it is. And, right, this conversation that is a lingering and long and ongoing conversation about the status quo and how our whole system was made to remain just the way it is, working exactly the way it is for the only people that it's working for, right, will maintain its place and time. I think the last one that I really wanted to talk about was this thing that I think is really scary for the folks who've been in the political sphere for a long time. Many of them are aging out. Many of them, if they were in private industry or any other kind of public life, you know, they would have retired 15, 20 years ago. But large majorities of Americans support age limits for federal elected officials. We've talked about this with regard to the Supreme Court, the reality that, you know, I will just say it, if people are using their political positionality to make money for themselves and be able to create a legacy, they'll stay there as long as they possibly can. And I don't think that's good for an American public where the people my age and younger, I would say the older millennials and younger, don't feel like they have a voice, don't feel like those people understand anything about what they're experiencing. And then we get people who are close to our age, like J.D. Vance, and we're looking like, really, this is the one you picked? Give me a break. Right? So I think, you know, there's this sense of those people are there. They've been there way too long. They've, you know, kind of overstayed their welcome. But they are the ones who get to decide who gets to be in certain spaces. And, right, we have an age minimum for the presidency, age of 35. Why do we have an age maximum for federal, you know, elected officials? And not to say that people who are older are not capable. That is not the point. But at some point, you have to think about what is the legacy that you're leaving and how are you bringing up others? I even think about the state of Oregon and the fact that we have some elected officials who have been in their positions way too long and have not done the work to create a long legacy of bringing up people behind them. For me, as a leader, I believe you should be opening the door for more leaders and pulling them along with you and making sure that they get opportunities and that your legacy is not just what you did, but who you brought through the door with you. And I think we've just kind of lost that sense, that understanding that you sitting in the same space for 50 years doesn't really change the conversation much. It doesn't really bring us to where we are in 2024, especially if you've just been there and you haven't really brought forward any you know, remarkable creative solutions for devising, you know, a populace that is served by the people they are putting in place to that represent them. So age limits for the Supreme Court, age limits for federally affected elected officials, and then the last one is about the Electoral College. So this is where we get into a really interesting situation that many people, let me find this exact number. I just had it. Electoral College. It's like 60% of people think that the Electoral College should go. And once again, right, we've seen enough of the times, and even right now we're seeing polling. And also, you know, if you observe the political candidates, right, they're not coming to places like Oregon. They're not coming to tell us about what they want to do for us. They're just going to the places in which, because the Electoral College exists, which is a vestige of slavery, mind you, I just want to continue saying that, why wouldn't we want to change that? We got rid of slavery. Why would we want the vestige of slavery to still be determining who gets to run the country? And it's because it serves certain people. And the people who recognize that if they come in and they say we're going to change this one thing, they will be seen as radicals. But it's not a radical idea. It's a widely supported idea by the American people. One person, one vote. We don't care if there are 10 people in Wyoming and there's a million trillion people in California. Each person who votes, their vote should be counted equally. I'm sorry for the Wyomingians. Love you dearly, I'm sure. I don't know any of you. But I think there is this idea, especially for, you know, people who are running for office, who, if they say something that sounds to, of course, the establishment as radical, that the people will somehow reject it. No, the people absolutely support it. And so I'm wondering, how do we get politicians who are running for office to read reports like this, where they're getting an idea of what the people want and they show up to serve the people's interest, right? Because these are not radical ideas. These are widely accepted and quite reasonable ideas. Why would we want to maintain something, especially like the Electoral College, which really undermines the populace itself? I would love to be able to go and listen to Trump wax poetic in public about whatever the heck he's talking about, right? Because half the time I have no idea what he's talking about. But to be able to get that on camera and share that on my social media, I would love to be able to hear Jill Stein tell me about what she's going to do for Black people. Because, you know, I could read some nonsense a mile away. I would love to hear, you know, what any of these people would like to tell me about their political stance, what they would like to do for me and my community. But I never get to hear that because we only focus on the swing states, right? The swing states. Oh, well, you know, Pennsylvania and Ohio and all of these other places where it's just not those places. Pennsylvania, I'll give you that. But some of the places, you know, I don't know. Is it a system that actually supports all of us being fully engaged as voters, fully engaged as citizens? And I truly believe that if we were to be a progressive society, we would have to elect people who actually have looked into data like this and represent our interests. I just want to name something that Sonia is saying to really agree with my point. The reason elected officials don't serve our interests is not that they don't know what our interests are. Huh. Let me sit with that for a moment. I mean, I think they don't really want to know. Of course, if you have, you know, moneyed interests and people pulling on your purse strings and knowing that you need that money to get elected, you're going to look to them to tell you what you think. You're going to look to them to tell you what your interests are. And this is incredibly scary. And we've allowed this. And the Supreme Court has put a stamp on it that it's okay.
What do we do about that without control over the Supreme Court? And this is where it gets scary for me when people start, you know, talking about, you know, well, I can't vote for a Zionist. Well, they're both Zionists. Disgusting, right? It's disgusting. This is what we have to deal with. One of those might not actually be a Zionist, but is being controlled by the moneyed interests of Zionism. One we know is very much a Zionist. Has said and was signing people's Torahs to tell people what he would do with regard to his friend Benjamin Netanyahu. He continues to say that he meets privately, even though he's not currently the president, right? This is the real thing. So, you know, I feel like that whole system can't be changed unless we change who has controls, who has the power, or that revolution that we talk about that looks like love. And you know, I've always been a person to be cautioned by the idea of, oh, it'll be beautiful, it'll be amazing. No, revolutions kill. Revolutions are bloody. Revolutions incur loss. And I think for the folks who are planning to either sit this one out or, you know, think about what their role is in all of this and decide I can't do it either way, that's still a choice, right? Yeah, even a third party is still a choice. I mean, I think people should do what is in their hearts to do, absolutely. But I think this is where we find ourselves, and it's an incredibly terrible space. So with that, I thank you all for calling in and entertaining me today. We've got to keep the work. We've got to keep loving on each other and trying to find that space of hope that we can channel our frustration, channel our anger into doing something. So thank you so much. Be back at you next week. This has been Too Much Information. I'm Tracy, signing out for me and Abe. Talk to you next week.
This is Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act.